Welcome to the latest podcast from Bodywise, the Eating Disorders Association of Ireland. This episode features a public lecture entitled Fat, Thin and Body Politics, given by author and psychotherapist Professor Susie Orbach in Trinity College Dublin, May 18th, 2007. Further information on the works of Susie Orbach can be found in the show notes for this podcast. We would like to thank the event organisers, the Irish Analytical Psychology Association and Susie Orbach for granting us permission to record the lecture and make it available as a podcast from our website www.bodywise.ie.
So, we'll start the evening. As chairperson of the IAPA, I want to welcome everybody here tonight. This is the last lecture in our series for the year, and we have our seminar tomorrow. It's in Earlsford Terrace, just opposite the Conrad Hotel there, and I want to welcome our chairperson for the evening, Ellen O'Malley Dunlop, who will now introduce Susie to us.
Good evening, everybody. Professor Orbach brings a psychoanalytic lens to a series of social, interpersonal, and individual concerns. She has written widely about women's psychology and the construction of femininity, gender, and the making of the body, psychoanalysis and social policy, eating difficulties, obesity to anorexia, women and brands, globalism and body image, emotional literacy in business, education and government. Specifically within psychoanalysis, her interests are the body, gender, countertransference and the psychotherapeutic relationship. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Professor Susie Orbach to Dublin.
Thank you. Can you hear before I rush for the AV man? Thank you so much for inviting me. Okay, I'm going to talk about a problem that is endemic, it's widespread, and it's ubiquitous. And I want to call this problem body hatred. And it's a source of incredible anguish for millions and millions of women, literally millions of women throughout the world. And it's become one of the West's most successful exports. And I'll talk about that in a bit. And almost every day, certainly in the UK news or whatever country I seem to be in, there's some new focus on the body and body politics. So, you know, a few weeks ago, it was a scandal of London Fashion Week refusing to follow Israel and Madrid in terms of rethinking its policy to size zero models. Or there's an endless stream of scare stories about obesity, which I'll also talk about in a minute, which seems to have become the new demon. And meanwhile, in my consulting room and in conversations with friends and listening in particularly to teenagers, because I have a teenage daughter, there's widespread panic about fatness, about thinness, about the body. And at the same time, there's a sense that this is a very trivial subject. But I want to suggest that it isn't a trivial subject at all. It's a form of violence against women, which we don't really contextualize in that way. And it's very far from being a trivial subject. It's a marauder of girls' and women's lives here and throughout the world. And like other horrors of the corporate state, it's really seeped into all of our consciousness and affects us deeply, or if it doesn't affect us, it affects our sisters, our lovers, our mothers, our daughters, and increasingly our sons, while it yields enormous profits for those who benefit from it. So there's been some political analysis of body politics, but many commentators, particularly in the last 5 years, have inadvertently bought into the agendas of big business, who identify, I think it's a really interesting phenomenon, phony culprits in order to draw away criticism from themselves. Now, much analysis is, to me, is thus faulty or superficial, and often steeped in unexamined prejudices such as thin is good, fat is bad, that kind of analysis, engendering rather facile discussion within these tiny parameters. And what I think psychoanalysis can do is to investigate how ideology, which is what I think fat is bad and thin is good, how ideology turns into belief and into prejudice. So psychoanalysis explores the personal or the subjective experience and meaning of why certain themes become compelling to us. And I don't really mean this in some sort of oversimplistic way by saying, well, we in the West have so much wealth, and so we're very guilty about that, so we are, you know, we deprive ourselves of food, or think we should, or we eat too much because we feel so guilty about our greed. I think those kinds of analyses can be made, but I don't think that's what's interesting about what psychoanalysis has to offer to a discussion of eating difficulties, of fat or of thin politics. It's at the feeling level, I think, that psychoanalysis, and by psychoanalysis I want to include all of its children, counseling, psychotherapy. I'm not trying to privilege psychoanalysis as anything different than something to do with listening with a certain kind of ear that's trained and that relates to complex processes. But it's at the feeling level that prejudice takes root, creating body panic and body hatred. And I think it's this pervasive phenomena that is helped by psychoanalytic understanding. So I'm going to try and throw some of that in today. And that understanding then needs to link up with ordinary economic and political and sociological understanding, because it's not an understanding in and of its own. And part of the extraordinary difficulty in addressing body hatred is that despite its prevalence and its damage, despite the pain and the mental health problems that it brings, girls and women take being troubled for their body, about their bodies, completely for granted. It's something they don't question, they just experience it as a force of gravity. In fact, the situation is even more complicated. Visual culture, at the intensity with which it's now experienced, is a serious player in the construction of body hatred. And it encourages girls and women to believe that transforming their bodies to reflect a version of what they see is in their own best interests. And it leads girls and women to engage in extraordinary practices that thwart their appetites and their longings, as an expression of looking after themselves. And the kind of disturbing bit is that the girls and women then, us, I'm not going to exclude myself, then believe that in doing harm, we're really doing something very, very good for ourselves. So to make the point about visual culture first, this is a picture of Times Square in New York, and the yellow is blocking out all the advertisements. So I just think it's worth recognizing that we don't ever see a space without advertisements. Okay, maybe in a church, but then there's a different kind of iconography there. Okay? So now let's have a sort of look at what the advertisements or the images look like. And I think this is Sicily. It's a clothing company. It's a recent image. And it's worth looking at this pose because it shows a faceless woman. The important thing to recognize about this ad is that it's not beamed at men. Okay, it's girls and women who are targeted with this image. And in absorbing it, they construct a relation to self which involves seeing themselves as a kind of site for voyeurism. Okay, here's another couple of... In these images, the models' heads are presented as larger than their bodies, a bit like a baby or a toddler. I mean, in fact, their heads are bigger because one assumes that there's an anorexia going on here. I mean, we don't know because it's not clear to me why they haven't photoshopped to get rid of that. So there is something about playing into the little person, the baby or the toddler. So the women have become diminutive and doll-like and vulnerable at the same time as they're not really approachable, right? I mean, it's a really interesting conjunction. And the thin image, obviously, is presented as desirable, and its effect on young women and women is to say, this is modern woman, this ought to be your aspiration. Then there are these kinds of magazines, which unfortunately littered my house for many years. And the images in the magazines, which start being attractive to girls at about age 11, by sort of 16, 17, they read the more ironic celebrity magazines. They're designed to make girls and women feel insecure, and the editorial copy is driven entirely by the advertising. Okay, the copy's usually about fashions that fit only a few, increasingly plastic surgery, cosmetic surgery, and some advice about what boys want and what you shouldn't eat and how many calories you might burn in oral sex, or actually not burn, how many you may ingest by mistake in oral sex. But it's not just the magazines, it's the moving images from TV and movies and pop videos which construct a certain kind of visual landscape for young women. And obviously it's the reality TV shows, particularly the makeover shows, like Extreme Makeover or The Swan, which sets up every part of the body as a part that needs to be criticized and remade. And it's not uncommon for girls today to be getting breast jobs and nose jobs at 16, with more judicious parents waiting till they're 18. And, I mean, this is happening in a lot of countries. Now, I thought you might want to just see this photoshopped face where the photographer was asked to change every single aspect of this person except her lips. Well, but, you know, this is a standard job that any photographer will do. So the bodies that we live, and this is the difficulty, are the outcome of our dialogue with the representation of the bodies that we see. And this is a kind of lively, but it's a very asymmetrical dialogue with the images around us determining our own relationship to our body, because we feel impelled to desire and to have something a bit like the bodies I've been showing you. The thing about visual language that's really interesting is that outside, it's unlike verbal language, it kind of occurs outside of conscious awareness. It just sort of enters into you. And then you're primed to make your own corporeality, your own physicality, within the context of the images you see. It's not that you're being a passive idiot, it's that these images then represent something very profound about physicality, or very omnipresent, maybe I should say, rather than profound. So you can't help but enter into some kind of exchange or relationship or dialogue with these kinds of image. What's really been interesting in the period of time that I've been working as a psychotherapist is the democratization of beauty. And we've seen beauty spread from... really from the time, a very limited time where you were supposed to be getting a husband, or You know, I mean, every teenager now has to be gorgeous. It's not. I was just listening to Joanna Lumley on Desert Island Discs this morning, and she was talking of the time of when she was a teenager, and it was very exceptional for anybody to be preoccupied with their body at that time. You might have worried about spots, but that was about it. Well, by six or seven, the notion of beauty is already something that girls are invested in, and increasingly boys. And the democratization kind of relates to social class and the longevity of the preoccupation. It's no longer reserved, as I said, for marriage or for the glamour industries or for courtiers, or it's become imperative to women. And women enact the beauty ideals as an expression of their personal agency. But at the same time as the idea that the sort of the idea of beauty has become democratized, the ideal of beauty has become narrow and narrow and narrow. So you get the conjunction of more and more people being brought into this being an essential aspect of themselves, but with a smaller and smaller ideal to which they can meet. Now, in a recent study that I did with a colleague from Harvard, we were shocked to find out that even though beauty is this incredibly crucial category, only 2% of women across the world feel able to use that word in relation to themselves. And um, 90% of women, as you can see, want to change at least one aspect of their physical appearance. So I want to call this really a public health emergency. I don't think we should be pretending that this is a trivial problem. Not only do I think it's a violence against women, but I think it's a public health emergency. And we have an epidemic of eating disorders. We have estimates of between 70 and 80% of girls and women manipulating their food every single day, making it the norm to have troubled eating. Okay? And in my daughter's year at school, there are no girls who eat when they're hungry, choose the food they want, and stop when they're full. It's simply not a category they know about. It's quite the next generation of eaters is completely divorced from any straightforward biological response to hunger. And one of the very disturbing results of the kind of eating that these girls are doing is that it's nearly always with the notion of restriction, that they shouldn't be eating. So they are restricting, whether it's a formal diet or an informal diet, and there's a lot of evidence to show that the minute you start restricting, you create the conditions for binging, both psychologically and biochemically. And it's of no great satisfaction to have seen, I don't know if any of you read American Psychologists, but Tracy Mann and her colleagues at UCLA last month confirmed what we've known for a very long time, that dieting makes you fat. But every single follow-up study shows that following dieting, if you follow it up 6 months, a year, 2 years, 3 years later, the weight gain is much the weight is higher than the base weight at which the person started their diet. And a much more serious problem, apart from the fact that you, or maybe I should say, an aspect that people are trying to understand is the way in which dieting interferes. Or constant dieting, which is what girls are doing these days, interferes with your set point, the sort of thermometer, the regulator, which speeds or slows down your metabolism on a normal basis if you've eaten more or you've eaten less. That seems to, if you can constantly diet, you're cheating your body into feeling that it's starving, and therefore your set point gets reduced. Your rate of your metabolism gets lowered rather than speeds up. Okay, so What psychoanalysis, I'm sorry it's not a prettier picture, helps us to understand is the way in which the outside, and in this case what I'm talking about is the myriad of images from the style industries, how that gets inside, so that having this westernized, photoshopped, very young body becomes a personal desire of the individual. It's not so much, I don't think, a straightforward question of the PR and the advertisers just being incredibly canny. I don't think that's a sufficient explanation. But, I mean, I think they are very canny and I think they are very clever. But how the individual comes to desire what is proposed and to reject what initially they may find problematic. And I want to just give you a really ordinary example. We all do this routinely. Fashion changes, bodies, typography, furniture, lighting, clothing, hairstyles, the phrases we use, even the cuisines we once imbibed, we now consider to be incredibly old-fashioned, and we just wouldn't even consider eating, you know, those kinds of foods anymore. So what happens? We may initially be unwelcoming to the new food, fashion, furniture, lighting, typography, bodies that we see. And we may think, okay, I really don't want to wear stripes with flowers. Or we may even feel a kind of revulsion for wide trousers if we've been wearing narrow ones. And we may feel dismay, even a certain revulsion about a look, particularly if it's, let's say, the heroin chic look, or that sort of come and get me look, whatever it is. But these new images pour at us, all in the same vein, and they fill our visual field. And the tight trousers that were once so much part of who we are come to feel shabby. I think this is what happens inside of us. They feel unrepresentative of who we feel ourselves to be or how we want to be seen now. And instead, the trousers or the stripes with the flowers or the skinny model being unwelcome, we come to feel that it is us in ourselves, in our own bodies, in our own clothing, in our own attitudes that have got it wrong. We feel out of step with ourselves. So psychoanalysis studies the process by which that which doesn't belong to us, which is not of us, and furthermore is initially experienced as being malign or bad, is transformed to become something that becomes our desire, right? Because it's how does the bad stuff suddenly, well, what is the process by which it becomes attractive to us? And how psychoanalysis inquires is that indigestibility, that's what's been done to one. And you could apply this in terms of ordinary stories that you hear of violence or abusive relationships. I don't think this is particular to fashion or style, but I want to apply it to style. How does what's been done to us that's indigestible get turned into an aspect of the individual's own longing and a propellant for their sense of their own agency? And how is the assault, if you like, recast in such a way that the person is rendered not a victim, but an actor in their own desire? So they'll no longer call it their own misfortune, they make it into their own desire. And it's in the very embrace of the market's propositions that she finds the means by which she overcomes the sense of being a subject. By engaging with what's out there, she becomes active. She becomes an active subject rather than being subjected. The power of the images to offend or hurt is rendered less offensive and less potent by the individual's realigning herself in the position inside of herself of wanting to mirror those images and get some power for herself. So it's a kind of, by enacting what has been done to one, by taking it up, one gains a kind of sense of power. So the image is no longer discordant, and it's her sight line that's been faulty that she can fix. So she's now energized to make the things that are out there, her own signature, and to express herself through these new forms. So she applies herself to the job of perfecting that image for herself and makes it her own and not alien and not horrible. Now, body troubles and body hatred are spreading. Consider, for example, the young African woman who writes to the editor of Marie Claire saying that she looks like the models on the front of Marie Claire, except that she's got a bloated stomach. She's got a bloated stomach from starvation. Or consider the six-year-old who won't go to the beach because she feels fat, or the fact that there are women in old age homes who've had anorexia or have been controlling their eating for 60 years. Okay? Now, a lot of the time we're dealing with a problem that's fat in the head. But all of these women responding to trying to be active in relation to their experience of the thin aesthetic. And they perceive this mono imagery as an aspect of identity which they must take on in the making of their own identity. And one of the things that has really disturbed me is that this phenomena, as I said in the beginning, is not confined to the West. Let me see if this comes in. So, for example, in 1995, you get television introduced to Fiji, one channel showing things like Friends. And within 3 years, you've got 11.9% of the teenage girls with bulimia. And when you ask them, why do they have bulimia? They say, oh, it's really great because then we can look like those girls, and they don't feel themselves to be doing anything wrong. They feel that they're entering modernity. This is their chance to enter modern culture. In China, one of the more popular operations in the big cities is a 10 centimeter insertion of a rod in the upper thigh to produce extra height so that there's a level playing field with the West. In Iran, 35,000 nose jobs are done under the hijab. I find that really interesting. In Brazil, as you will well know, where there was an emphasis on bottoms, now most of the plastic surgery is done to provide kind of Disney versions of breasts. So it's a kind of, the westernized body has captured these countries. And it's just very, very depressing. Now, the mother-daughter relationship is the most crucial influence on a girl's relationship to her body. And I think what's happening now, and why we're seeing this absolute explosion of body hatred and eating difficulties, is that mothers who themselves have been the targets of the industries that I'm going to talk about in a minute are bringing to their baby daughters such distressed bodies themselves that what they're passing on with mother's milk is bodies that are anxious, bodies that are distressed, bodies that don't feel comfortable eating, bodies that are in extreme difficulty. And I think one of the things about celebrity culture, which is, I don't know if it's captivated Dublin, but it's certainly captivated London and New York and Los Angeles and other places, is this trend to having your baby early by C-section in the mistaken belief that you will not gain weight and that you will be able to get back to your pre-pregnancy weight very fast, as though this is some kind of goal of early mother-child relationship. And one of the things that really worries me about the new trend towards cesareans is that it, and particularly the way it's talked about in these magazines that are so compelling to young people, is that you get the picture of these young mums being totally caught up with their bodies rather than their relationship with their babies from the beginning of life. And that establishes a whole set of patterns in which the soothing receptors for the baby, instead of being based on oxytocin, which is a bonding hormone, is based on a very high stressor hormone, which is cortisol, which means that the person needs to be very stressed in order to produce any kind of analgesic for themselves. So now we come to the commercial culprit, who can only thrive if the eating of sufficient numbers of people is chaotic. And I'd like to draw your attention to these figures. They're very old, because we don't have new figures. But I think it's quite interesting that the United States spends more on diet products than it does on education. And for most women at this point in the West, dieting is a kind of normal state of affairs, or they should be, and that's certainly what the kids are feeling. Now, I suppose I'm going to say the obvious here, but if dieting worked, you'd only have to do it once, right? So these companies rely on a 97% failure rate, okay? Otherwise, they wouldn't be making profits. You have to be cyclically involved, whether it's paying Weight Watchers fees or buying their foods, but it doesn't really matter which company you think of, but they wouldn't be making any money if it worked. If we look at the pharmaceutical end of the industry, even when drugs are entirely useless or extremely dangerous, as is the case with Fen-Phen, which I think gave an absolute maximum loss of £6, but caused heart failure in so many cases that it had to be withdrawn after a huge fight in which they spent I don't know how many millions, and it literally was millions, in PR to keep it going. People have the belief, and the pharmaceutical companies pump out almost every month the new wonder drug that you should invest in, you should be looking for, that you should be thinking about. And I think one of the things that's really worried me, not just about the pharmaceutical interest in this, but about the diet industries and the kind of thin aesthetic, is that there's quite some interesting evidence that if you have, this is from the Dutch famine in the Second World War, that women who were exposed to famine in the first 6 months of their pregnancies had underweight children who then went on to become obese. So if you think of the kind of skinniness that girls are being encouraged to be now, and you think of this Dutch famine result, it's quite worrying, because those who had famine in the first 6 months of their pregnancy produced underweight children who went on to be obese. The ones who were hungry in the last bit of their pregnancy did not produce the same kind of phenomena. The babies were not primed to become fat. Okay, let's look at obesity for a moment. And in 1995, the World Health Organization revised what constituted obesity. And, Brad Pitt and George Bush, overweight, and really George Clooney, obese? I mean, really, how can the world's most gorgeous man be considered obese? Something wrong there. So I think we can all see how preposterous this is. So who actually got this change? Something called the International Obesity Task Force sounds ever so respectable. They were funded by the drug companies who have an interest in treating obesity and promoting it as a disease. It's moved into a disease entity. So let's get a few facts out. These are the claims on American figures, because the British have not, and the Irish, I don't know the Irish at all, I'm sorry to be. But these claims, on their own reanalysis, the National Institutes of Health have had to say, no, there's not 365,000 obesity-related deaths in America. Actually, you wonder why the Americans would mind, because it would cut down on their Social Security and their Medicaid and things like that, really. I mean, I've never really understood that argument from their point of view. Anyway, they were forced to reanalyze their data and show that the obesity-related deaths were 25,500. Not great, but not what they were doing, not the creation of an ideological story. And the same is the claims of childhood obesity. They had to reanalyze that because anybody who's somehow slightly pudgy was in that obesity statistic. Now, what's really interesting is that far from overweight creating a health risk, the most protective weight for health purposes is this BMI of 27.5. But most people, I think, know that a BMI is a completely phony measure. It was invented for all sorts of crazy reasons when statistical measurements were the rage in the 19th century and during eugenics and all of that. And most people in the field accept that if you're really looking at health-related problems, you need to be looking at girth over here, because there's particular kinds of girth that indicate problems around heart disease and diabetes, and that the BMI is not really very relevant. People know if they're too large. They really do. Then, of course, we've got the beauty industry, which is big and growing. And it grows by producing more and more products and finding more and more markets. So the younger the market, you know, you can segment the market and you can sell this to this. That's how you do it. Now, what's interesting about these figures, and I want to point out this, is that the annual growth of of beauty is 7%. That is how much the beauty market grows each year, compared to our growth, which is, and I know you're phenomenal in Ireland and you're one of those tigers, but I mean, I don't, what is Ireland's GDP growth at the moment? What is your growth? Okay, so beauty is doing better than that. You know, Nivea and L'Oreal, 14%. And just look at what is spent on promotion, 20 to 25% of the budget. So, I want to say that the imperative of the narrow beauty ideal is deadly. Again, from the same study that showed only 2% of women worldwide felt beautiful, this shows a very shocking figure that of the critical lens that girls have when they look at themselves. 72% of girls avoiding ordinary activities. I mean, I was really shocked about that. And then the specific figures. And I think what these figures add up to is a modern version of bound feet. And like bound feet, girls accept this as part of their identity. And they try to make, as I said earlier, the manifestation of this version of bound feet an expression of their own desire. So, my last slide. So, I think what I want to say is that these images are very, very powerful. And throughout the world, girls and women are grappling with the asymmetry of these images. And brands invest very heavily in spending, and their spending works. And where once religious iconography penetrated the consciousness of people, brand iconography conveys the particular kinds of bodies. It's conveyed by particular kinds of bodies today. And because the market demands constant economic activity, we also become primed to change, to look out for and to yearn for those images which will help situate ourselves with just the right, albeit fleeting, identity markers. So it's not just the Starbucks or the hotel chains with which the world traveler can reassure her or himself of continuity and belonging. It's in a deeply personal manner through the appropriation of a body that is recognizable that a woman makes her way in the world. And Identity and bodies are formed with reference to our particular world. And the global economy and visual culture make an impression on the individual. And the individual, in making the response, feels herself to be part of that world. But she can't be secure in her physicality or her corporeality because it's very contingent, it's very unreliable and very steady. But what she has understood is that she needs to be at the ready to transform her body and treat it like a doll that she puts things on and off of all the time. And her desire to do so and her enthusiasm for the project of transformation becomes an aspect of self which she embraces and anticipates with a certain pleasure. And I think what I'm seeing with younger women now is that their body becomes their brand, if you like, not by the clothes they wear, but by the representation of the size that they can project or the image that they can project. They project the brand that says, I belong to womanhood, I belong to femininity, I have rights. And if they can't, if they feel they can't do it, they feel completely and utterly disenfranchised. So, I hope in my talk I've been able to persuade you that this is a topic that's ready for political consideration and for consideration as a topic around women and violence, that this isn't a trivial subject. And I think the situation is very urgent. I would like us to bring it into political discourse and to stop it being segmented into just eating disorders over there, which somehow makes certain people very troubled and freaks or glamorous, depending on the way you see it. But to infuse much more of our conversation with, or listen out in our conversation for the number of times people are talking about the body in a distressed way. So I'm going to stop there, close my machine, bring the lights on, and maybe we can have a general conversation.